And so it begins. Welcome back to Press Play Action here on Jersey Nerds Productions. I'm Mitchell Lee alongside Brandon too. And in case you're wondering, what's beginning? What's starting? Huh? What are you doing? Is this becoming like a ping pong podcast? No, it's not. We are not talking ping pong. I think the Forrest Gump review is the closest we got to becoming a ping pong podcast. This is I was about to say Steven Spielberg. That's the wrong guy. Although we will get to him. We're talking about another prominent director, a man by the name of Quentin Tarantino. Ladies and gentlemen, we talked about him in Pulp Fiction, and we both gave that movie extremely high. I think we were both at an A-plus for that one. I don't think that we were very far off from each other at all, and I had a very high A-plus. So, Brandon, we come in today with one Tarantino movie under our belt, and we're going to review his first theatrically released picture, Reservoir Dogs, which came out in 1992. And then we're going to talk about his most financially successful and his biggest movie, Django Unchained, in 2012. And one of your, complaints with, we talked about this, I don't know whether we talked about it on the last podcast that went out or our Dune 2 review, which the computer gods just said, nah, no, we don't need one more person.
They're
just
saving it for March. It's okay.
Yeah, we'll hold that in the pocket until March. That's why we didn't have anything come out last week. But Brandon, you were curious as to why I grouped certain movies together.
I was. I believe that was the last podcast we technically did, but wasn't aired to the public.
And this is a bit of a pairing of From Humble Beginnings to a $100 million budget.
Ah, okay.
Which is the biggest budget of his career. This is his most financially successful movie. And it is probably the most, depending on who you ask, but it's certainly one of his most beloved. Both of these on the IMDb top 250, so we don't have to.
As they should be.
Like, for example, when we get to Kill Bill, Volume 2 is not on the IMDb top 250. So we're going to be reviewing that, but we're not going to be knocking out two birds with one stone, yeah, so to speak. Reservoir Dogs, however, and Django Unchained, they both are. Reservoir Dogs is sitting pretty at number 98.
Love that.
On the IMDb 250. Top 100. And Django Unchained is at 57.
Oh, top 60. Let's go.
And that's a movie that was in the top 40 when I first started like really looking at the IMDb top 250 in 2013. And most movies that came out around that time and they're in that range, they've fallen off by now or they're a lot lower. Right. Like Mad Max Fury Road was in the top 20 for a while.
And now it's like
230 or something.
Oh, 230. Wow. That's a steep drop off.
It's rare for stuff to stick around. I'm interested to see what happens with Dune 2 because that's currently in the top 10. But like Whiplash is stuck around, Interstellar is stuck around, Inception is stuck around,
yeah,
and Django Unchained has stuck around in there as well. But Quentin Tarantino, one of our most well-known directors, we talked about Pulp Fiction, and Pulp Fiction was really when most people started to take notice of him. It was kind of a cultural phenomenon, and it did very well financially as well, whereas Reservoir Dogs was kind of seen as, and again, I was born in 1994, this movie came out in 1992, so I can only really go off of what other people have said regarding the culture and this movie, but this movie was released on, it premiered at Sundance in 1992,
okay,
in January, and it was a movie that got exceptionally, you know, it got great reception there, but it was very underground.
Critics loved it, right? Like critics loved it, but it was like underground.
Critics loved it, but it did have its detractors as well. It was a 90%, but there were some people that were very, we'll talk about the scene that kind of rubbed people the wrong way when we get into the in-depth review for Reservoir Dogs. But it came out October 9th, 1992, and Brandon, this is something that just sounds like it's made up when you talk about Tarantino. This was the number 136th highest grossing movie of 1992. It made $2.8 million. It was only in 61 theaters at its widest point of release. It made less than movies like Crisscross, This Is My Life, Blame It on the Bellboy, The Gun in Betty Lou's Handbag, Peter's Friends. I bet Peter's Friends don't make movies the way that Quentin Tarantino does. So yeah, lots of stuff that no one has ever heard of made significantly less than Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, that kind of blows my mind, right? Because even if it gets praise at Sundance and is like this underground type of movie that like critics like, but it's not a mass audience appeal yet, it just seems so weird to me for it to only be released in like 61 theaters like nationwide and make that little of money. How much did it cost to make the movie?
Well, it costs, I want to say around $2 million. So it didn't make money, but it didn't lose. It wasn't really like marketed that
probably
much.
Probably got him his next movie, that the fact that it like broke even or
that's the
lost
thing.
Money. Yeah.
But I was texting you about this. I have an interesting story. Well, it's not my story. I just found it about the fact that this movie might have never have seen, maybe not seen the light of day is strong, but no one else would have seen it because Quentin Tarantino was working at a video store in California and was going to shoot this with his friends on a budget of $30,000 in black and white.
Like a Skinamarink type of move. Like he was.
I haven't seen that, but yeah.
But yeah, like low budget, like I'm just going to shoot this with my friends, like on
but
the
not
side.
Even necessarily like, hey, and we'll release it theatrically or anything. Just like,
just
hey,
I'm
going to
do this project.
Let's just make a movie. And the producer, Lawrence Bender, was playing a police officer in the role, and he gave the script to his acting teacher, and the acting teacher's wife gave the script to Harvey Keitel. And Harvey Keitel liked it enough that he's like, all right, I'm going to sign on as a co-producer and help you find funding for this movie and help you get this thing made. They raised $1.5 million.
Great, Harvey.
And Harvey Keitel was really a big proponent of this, and he helped them paid for them to host casting sessions in New York, where they got Michael Madsen, Steve Buscemi, and Tim Roth. There were also Viggo Mortensen and George Clooney read for roles, but they did not end up in the movie.
George Clooney in this movie would be very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't say who he was or he would have been.
Right.
But at the same time,
was
this
early
was
in like Buscemi's career and like Tim Roth's career? This was very early, right?
This was 3 years before Fargo.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not 100% certain as to what Buscemi was really doing at the time, but I know that Fargo is kind of like the movie that he's the most known for.
Right. But I guess my point was like,
things
these are kind of like,
seem to take off after this.
Relatively like not unknown actors, but like you want to consider them like A-list actors at the time. And then Harvey Keitel, who's like, you know, borderline pretty, you know, famous, gets on as the role too. So that's interesting.
He was in a few Coen Brothers movies. He was in Miller's Crossing and Barton Fink. And Coen Brothers are another one that we will get to eventually, but Reservoir Dogs was definitely one that kind of made him more, people were more aware of him after this. And then he started being in a bunch of 90s movies that are very well known, stuff like Fargo, Escape from LA, Con Air, Billy Madison, The Wedding Singer, The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, no, it just seems interesting the way the movie was made, or like you say that story with Keitel, like how it got in front of people's eyes, and then the decisions they made for like casting purposes and kind of casting people who fit the roles, but you like wouldn't think about it probably at the time, being like, is this movie even gonna work? Like they probably had to shoot the movie and put it all together to see if it actually worked as a movie, and that's a big risk on their part to like make the movie in general. So that's a pretty interesting story. Like, And like I said, this, I mean, the fact that it like broke even or maybe lost a little bit of money, probably got Tarantino his next movie. Probably was the reason why he got to his next movie. So
the fact that it was so well received, it's yeah, like, exactly. All right, let's get you to where the entire way through, you're doing it with this process. There's no point where you're like, hey, I got to like
marketing.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's see what you can do with, you know, more resources. And he knocked it out of the park with Pulp Fiction. But if I got to be honest with you, I think he knocked it out of the park with Reservoir Dogs. And there's somebody listening to this right now that is saying, Mitchell, all right, you're talking about all this stuff. What the hell is this movie about? Well, I'm getting there. Have some damn patience. All right. This movie is about a group of people that they don't know. It's like someone's going to want to kill me for saying this, but someone who watched a bunch of movies in the 2010s, it's my point of reference. It's like Baby Driver, and they have a bunch of people that are pulling a heist together, but they've never worked on a heist together before because this guy doesn't like to use the same group over and over again.
Right.
Just like in Baby Driver, and it's got these guys played by Harvey Keitel, Tim Roth, Chris Penn, Steve Buscemi, Lawrence Tierney, Michael Madsen. Quentin Tarantino's also in the movie very briefly. I know we've acknowledged that he's not a very good actor, and
Edward Bunker.
He's not in this either, but he's also not in it very long at all. And it's these guys, they're diamond thieves, and they try to rob a jewelry store, and it goes extremely wrong. And so they go to their hideout place, and it's kind of a, I don't want to say it's a bottle film because it definitely has different locations, but there's a vibe of they're in their little hideout area, and they're trying to find out, all right, the way that things were set up, there's no way that someone was not, this isn't some sort of, you know, there's not a rat here. Someone had to have told them that this was going to happen because like half of the crew died.
Like, we were set up. Like, it was plain as day they were set up, and someone was a quote-unquote the rat, and they had to sniff out the rat and stomp out the rat. And that's basically what the movie is. It's just, like, an entire, hour and 30 minutes of, like, I guess, in order or out of order, playing back the events leading up to and the events after this diamond heist gone wrong. And it's just
there's a lot of that Tarantino playing with time thing that you would see in something like Pulp Fiction. And I saw a lot of Pulp Fiction in something like this. I saw a lot of Pulp Fiction and I saw a lot of Hateful Eight. And we'll get to Hateful Eight here in a few weeks as we continue on with the Tarantino. But I saw a lot of the inspiration for that in this movie, in that you have a lot of strangers and none of them trust each other.
I think that's the biggest key, right?
Well, unlike the Hateful Eight, where you kind of have time to sit and breathe with these characters and then the mistrust starts, this throws you in right away to the point where it took me a little bit to be like, all right, where are we going? What's going on? Because at first, it's just them talking at a diner and all the people having a conversation, and then there's blood and a lot of blood. And Tim Roth's character's in the back of the car. He thinks he's going to die. Harvey Keitel's driving him saying, hey, we're going to go to this hideout place. And then Joe, which is the person that kind of puts everyone on, played by Lawrence Tierney.
I guess he's the mob boss, right?
He's the one that kind of has everything situated.
Yeah, he's the thread between everybody. He's the central connection. He's the guy who doesn't like to reuse crews, but it's like amalgamation of all these different people that he would think would be perfect for this job, but none of them know each other. And it's just an interesting way of doing it. And they all have code names too, and all the code names have to do with color. And it's like, you're not going to give away your actual name. You're going to be going by Mr. White or Mr. Orange or Mr. Blonde, Mr. Brown, Mr. Blue. You're not allowed to say your real name to anybody, because in case this goes wrong, we have to have deniability. We have to have a way to get out of this. So the only thing we know is what each other looks like, and we're not supposed to know anything else past that. And it's actually like really well set up in terms of like, that's probably what you would do if you were trying to pull off a diamond heist. You'd probably want to know the least amount of information about the people you were pulling the heist with in some points in, you know, circumstances. It's just a very interesting film, and maybe we can dive more into how it is set up. But yeah, you're right. It just throws you right into it. There's just blood all over the backseat of a car, and you're like, what is going on? And it's just Tim Ross' character bleeding out. And that's kind of, he just throws you into it at first.
There's a thing in this movie that I think stupid people would have a problem with this, but I don't think I'm stupid, so I don't have a problem with this. And that's the fact that you never really see the robbery go down. It's all you hear about things that happen. And I like the fact that it lets your mind connect the dots between things. And also, if you say, like, so-and-so was just going off, and you know, you can, what you are imagining is probably more interesting than what they're going to put on the screen. But also, unlike most of Tarantino movies now, where it's, you know, a 2 hour, 30 minute extravaganza, this is a tight hour 39. And so, I mean, with a smaller budget, it kind of had to be. So they get you in, they get you out, and the focus is kept on the mystery, but also getting to know some about these characters. And you kind of piecing together, all right, well, if this person's got this going on, then that means maybe that person's the one that can't be trusted. But wait, no, right, that person's losing their mind right now. So I don't think they'd be doing that.
And then it's like, oh, well, you never heard anything about Mr. Blue. So, like, is it Mr. Blue's the rat? Like, I think
we also have Eddie Bunker, all the dead people.
Right. I mentioned Eddie Bunker, and I think his character is so fascinating. Because Tarantino could have showed Mr. Blue, like, dying, Mr. Blue's, like, backstory, and he is, like, the biggest mystery in the entire film. It's just like, well, Mr. Blue died. It's just like, we have no idea what happened to him, but yeah, we got out of there. He got shot up, and, like, everyone's just going their different ways, and there's just all this information coming out. It's like, okay, so you made it out, Mr. Blonde. You made it out. Okay, Mr. Brown, Tarantino's character, didn't make it out. He got shot in the head. It's like, so what happened to Mr. Blue? And it's like, oh, he's dead. Like, you just hear, like, secondhand information. Like, oh, he dies. And, like, you never see it. And I think, to me, that's, like, a fascinating way to handle a character where you are kind of like, no, but I kind of want to know a little bit about Eddie Bunker's character. I kind of want to know, like, what happened to him, but, like, I don't think that's the point. I don't think the point is to talk about Mr. Blue. And the point is to focus on the other four guys that are, like, involved in the heist. So it's just a very interesting take on it. I don't know. Like, outside of the opening scene, how long did it take you to kind of get into it? Because for me, as soon as you see Tim Roth, like, giving his performance, and, you know, Keitel's, like, doing his thing, yeah, I kind of, like, bought in, like, immediately. And I know this was, like, a rewatch for me. Like, the first time I saw it, I probably didn't buy in as quickly. But upon rewatch, I bought in, like, within, like, you know, 10 minutes or less. I was like, okay, I'm into this movie. Like, I don't know where this is going, but, like, I'm here for it. So, I guess, when did you start buying in, I guess?
Well, I was bought in just from the fact that it was a Quentin Tarantino movie, and I kind of trusted that I was in good hands. Right. But I go into every movie blank slate, no matter who's directing it, who's in front of the camera, behind the camera, all that stuff. So I guess once multiple people started showing up at the hideout, I think once Steve Buscemi came in, because at first it's Harvey Keitel and it's Tim Roth, and Tim Roth's just losing massive amounts of blood, where he keeps telling him, like, hey,
honestly,
you're gonna be
all right. I have no idea how, like, he's not dead. Like, I don't know how he didn't die.
He keeps saying, like, hey, you're gonna be all right. And I'm like, I really don't think that's true. This man has lost Gatorade buckets of blood. I don't think he's gonna be okay, man. Right. But then Steve Buscemi comes in, and it's not just, hey, is this guy okay? It's, no, what happened? what, like, he comes in it's just chaotic. Flustered.
Yeah,
and you definitely get the vibe of someone. Some movies can try this type of thing where it's like, man, it was crazy, it was chaotic, but it doesn't feel lived in quite that well. This makes you really feel like these people just got back from pulling off a heist that went terribly wrong, and just they'd love to lay low, but they're furious and they need to figure out what exactly happened. And so I really think that Steve Buscemi's character is the one that kind of got me over the top as far as getting me from, all right, where's this going? What's this about? To I'm in.
Yeah, now I'm in. Yeah. And but, I think for me, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, but that's not a slight on the rest of the cast because I was really impressed. I usually do not like Michael Madsen. I don't think he's a very good actor, but I really liked him in this. I think that this is probably the best role that he's had, at least that I can remember.
He might be the best character.
I would disagree with that.
I mean, I don't think he is, but you can make the argument. Yeah, you can make the argument that he is.
I really liked the Harvey Keitel, Tim Roth dynamic that's set up early in the movie, but especially, man, this is going to be the second straight Tarantino review that we talk about where I'm just here like, Harvey Keitel, this guy is fantastic. This
really
made me want to dive deep and made me want to go watch something like Mean Streets from the 70s when he was in with De Niro. And again, Martin Scorsese, another prominent director. We will get to him. But this, he just works so well with Quentin Tarantino. He saw something in this script, and I think that he was really able to sink his teeth into this character in a way that a lot of other actors wouldn't be able to bring the kind of lived-in sincerity that this guy has. But he also just seems like, in a room full of people like Steve Buscemi and Michael Madsen and Chris Penn, who just want to fly off the handle, he's the one that's kind of got a little bit more of a cool head.
Right.
And in a lot of movies, the one that does fly off the handle is the one that's more attention grabbing.
And that's Michael Madsen. Yeah.
Yeah. And in this movie, I think the one that's more cool, calm, collected is the one that stands out more to me. But Michael Madsen is the one, and we'll get to this more in spoilers. Michael Madsen has a part in this movie that a lot of people really objected to, but
I'm assuming it's the scene with the cop, right? I mean, I'm guessing people
which
did not like that.
I understand.
It's borderline sarcastic. I mean, it really is.
I don't think borderline needs to be applied there.
It's over the line psychotic, but it's insane. I don't know if I fully agree with it, and it's kind of wild, but I also kind of understand from the point of view of, like, if you really want to, like, hammer home this guy's a psychopath, like, well, that's one way to do it, you know? Like, definitely, there was no tiptoeing around the line. It was, let's kick the door in and run through the door and you know, breach it and, you know, throw some flashbangs and get in there and really, you know, break down the door. So, I can see why people don't like the scene. We can get to that later in spoilers. I think that's kind of why I'm like, I agree with you that Madsen's not the best character. And I actually think I might have a different opinion from you in terms of who's the best character. But I think Buscemi and Keitel, there's a dynamic of chaotic fever and like anxiety, and then you know, like you were saying with Keitel, like a calm, cool, and collected, like, all right, like, I understand you're going off the deep end, Mr. Pink, like, you want to like run, like, we need to get out of here, but look, Mr. Orange is in the corner bleeding out, like, we got to get him some medical attention. So it's very interesting. I mean, I guess we can jump into, how do you feel about the guys who weren't part of the heist? So, like, Lawrence Tierney and Chris Penn with, like, Nice Guy Eddie. How do you feel about that dynamic with the father and son and kind of, like, how those characters interacted with the rest of the cast? Because I think that's the real, like, crux of the movie is like you get this heist, but then you get like Joe and Nice Guy Eddie kind of being like, well, like we paid you guys to do this job, like, or like we're paying you to do this job correctly, like what the fuck happened. And yeah, I think it's really brilliant how they kind of tied together, but I kind of want to get your thoughts on like Penn and Tierney's characters.
I think that those parts of the movie were fine. The cutaway parts to kind of stuff that happened before. I didn't really care quite as much about the whole father son dynamic. That's fair. It just kind of felt a little bit repetitive about, he kind of felt like he needed to prove himself type of thing. It felt more out of place in the movie to me personally, whereas I liked the dynamic with like the conversation they have with Michael Madsen. I think that that was like, that set things up, and I did like that. And it was also a nice contrast because he doesn't exactly act the same in every single scene.
No, exactly. He's not. He doesn't give off an aura of sociopathic tendencies. You know, yeah. He kind of hides that, but like it's down there.
There's also a few scenes where they show not the heist, but just kind of them trying to get away from the scene of the crime,
right?
And get to their car to go to the hideout type of thing.
I like those scenes a lot.
And those scenes were tense. They were tough. It was, you definitely felt the stress, especially, well, I won't say especially Steve Buscemi, because there's one later on as well where it's just like, I don't know how you guys are getting out of this. And oh, no, people are dropping, you know?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
And I really appreciated that about it, that people weren't just impervious to bullets. That,
yeah, that's fair.
People, I mean, most, like half of the people that you see at the dinner table or the lunch table or whatever, you do not see again unless it's a flashback to them dying in the heist.
Right.
There's a lot of people. If you don't really recognize someone at that dinner table, they don't recognize what's going on the rest of the movie because they haven't read the script because they're dead. They're like, hey, we need you for one scene, and then you're dying. Goodbye.
Yeah. Like, if you're Eddie Bunker and you sign up for this part, Tarantino's like, all right, man, I need you to sit there for this brunch and, you know, make one offhand comment, and then you can peace out. Deuces, we don't need you anymore. Like, we need you in two shots. We need you in the brunch scene, and we need you walk into the car. That's the only thing we need. Everything else, you're golden, man. Just go collect the paycheck and go call it a day. Really, if you think about it, what, there was 9-8 people at the brunch table, and five of them are dead.
Yeah.
By the halfway point of the movie, like it's kind of crazy to think.
By the way, there is a point in the movie where they're talking about Pam Grier.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting because Pam Grier's in Jackie Brown.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just thought that was interesting.
He's just tying it in. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I guess maybe he just always admired Pam Grier. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe she had nice feet, knowing Tarantino.
Fair. I mean, we're not going to get into that. But
we'll save that for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
True. So the one other thing I wanted to touch on was the music. I especially enjoyed how the music in this one particular radio station was tied into like the plot of the movie almost because of how they
used it. It was like John Wick 4 when at the end of the movie they have that one like French DJ that's like, this one goes out to you, John Wick. You have nowhere left to run. And then it's like, nowhere to hide now, baby.
Yeah. I what was it? It was K Billy's superpower like 70s station, I believe it was
something
what it was
like
called.
That.
Yeah, I thought it was very very interesting how it was like tied into the movie almost. Bros. And I guess we can get in that with Django, because Django does an amazing job of like tying the music.
I was just about to say, I'm going to hold off on the praising Tarantino for needle drops until we get to Django. But right. Yeah, K. Billy, it's almost like he was sitting back watching the movie and just like, oh, I think this song will go well. This one goes out to you, Mr. Orange, with your dumb ass. Like,
yeah, exactly. It's just like, what would have made it more funny is if it had been like, I shot the sheriff. If that like had happened at any point in the script, that would have been hilarious. But I just think it
I was just thinking about really what funny. Movie I saw. I was like, I swear I saw a movie with that song in it.
Was it the Bob Marley Tarantino? Oh, okay.
No, it was the Bob Marley movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course, but I just thought, that's really the only thing I have for this movie outside of like getting into spoilers. I also do want to touch on the way this movie is edited is wild. Like the decisions they make to edit this movie is kind of wild. But yeah, I'm here for it, and you'll see with my grade. I think this is like one of the most brilliantly edited movies in like really all of cinema. Like I think
let's dive in. Brandon, you want first crack at this thing?
Yeah, I'll go ahead. Let me pull up my letterbox grade. Yep. It's very high, as you saw last night on my letterbox. I'm giving this an A+, 80.8. And for reference, Top Gun Maverick, which I absolutely loved from 2 years ago, I gave an A+, 81.0.
Okay, so I think this movie,
I think this movie is awesome. It'd probably win best movie of the year for me on most years, or win like the top three for sure. This movie is awesome. And I think the way it is edited, the way it is directed, the way it's written, and then the acting on top of that, there's just some outstanding performances. And this is quintessential Tarantino, and I love it as a debut film for him as a director. Because it's like an awesome way to be like, this is my first movie I've ever like really put out there. Like, I'm putting it all on the table, and he really does.
By the way, do you know, I forgot to get to this at the beginning of, I usually talk about Oscars. You know what all got nominated for this?
I would assume Keitel got nominated, or Tim Roth got nominated. And maybe cinematography, or like something to do with costumes, maybe even.
Well, guess what, Brandon? This movie got zero nominations at the Oscars.
Zero. Nothing.
None.
Even like a Harvey Keitel or Tim Roth?
Nope. Best picture that year went to Unforgiven by Clint Eastwood, which I've heard is a fantastic movie. I haven't seen it, but I've heard great things about it. And if I have to say it again, I'll say it a billion times. Clint Eastwood, we'll get to him.
Right.
But Unforgiven seems to be a strong best picture winner. For Reservoir Dogs, we're in another American Beauty type situation.
Right.
Where I just can't get quite as high on the Reservoir Dogs supply that you did. But sure, that does not mean that I don't love it. It's a 78.89% on the A scale for me, which is just below, which is just below American Beauty for me. I do love this movie, and I think it's fantastic, but I do think that there are some times where the tone just feels a bit, it's just a bit off for me, whether it's that scene in where Michael Madsen's talking with the dad and the son. It just kind of throws me out of the mystery, or the Michael Madsen stuff where it kind of just goes a little bit too far in some places. And I know it makes it sound like, well, you just didn't like Michael Madsen. No, I really liked Michael Madsen. I just think Michael Madsen's in a lot of scenes. He's doing a really good job, but it just kind of feels a tad bit disjointed for me personally. But I understand that there are people who watch Tarantino movies and think that this is his best movie, that think that his top one out of the gate was Reservoir Dogs.
Personally, I think it's close. And I guess based off my grading scale, you will see how close I think it is.
Where was this compared to Pulp Fiction?
So I actually have this above Pulp Fiction because I have Pulp Fiction at 70.5 A+.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Right. I really like this movie. And that's not to say I don't like Pulp Fiction.
And you said I've only seen 81?
80.8.
Okay, so you have this slightly above where I have Pulp Fiction. I have Pulp Fiction at an 80.38. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
I will say this. I've only seen Pulp Fiction all the way through once, and so maybe if I continue to rewatch it, it will just like climb the scale for me. But I really, really like this movie. Like every time I rewatch it, and it's like that hour and 30 minutes. It's really an hour and 30 because of the credits at the end, so it's really like an hour and 32 minutes of just pure runtime. Those hour and 32 minutes, I just can't get enough of it. Like, I just think it's like quintessential Tarantino. And I know everyone loves Pulp Fiction and everyone loves Django, but this is like, I feel like this is his movie. This is like, yeah, this is who I am as a director. Like, we got other stuff, but this is me as a director. And I really appreciate that about it. And look, I totally understand, like, not liking the Michael Madsen scene, Mr. White scene, and the Mr. Blonde scene with the cop. I totally understand that. And quite frankly, it was a little gruesome for me, too. I probably threw up in my mouth a little bit. Like, I completely understand that. But I still think there's enough there. Where I just love this movie. I really do.
All right. Let's go ahead and dive into Django Unchained. Man. Once again, the man, the myth, the legend, Quentin Tarantino directed and wrote this. This stars Jamie Foxx, Christoph Waltz, Leonardo DiCaprio, Kerry Washington, Samuel L. Jackson, as well as other people. And it was released on Christmas of 2012. This was the first Tarantino movie that I ever... No, it's not. It's the second Tarantino movie I ever watched. It was the first one I ever saw in theaters. Fair. The first one I ever watched was Inglourious
Bastards. Did you sneak into it?
No, I was 18.
You were 18 by then. I don't think I was.
When it came out.
I think I was.
You were born the same year as me.
Yeah, you're right. Well, I didn't sneak into it. I had friends that sneaked into it because they were like 16 or, you know, they weren't old enough. But I will say I had friends that walked out of Les Mis and then went into this movie. That's how
much don't walk out of Les Mis. Les Mis
I know,
is a good
right?
movie.
Well, they didn't know Les Mis
not
was
as good
a musical.
As this, but Les Mis.
Yeah, they didn't know Les Mis was a musical and that was the reason why. Yes, which they should have known. But
I had a very similar experience with Les Mis because I watched it. And I was at this point where I'm like, I hate musicals. I don't want anything to do with musicals. No. But I was like, no. The first time I watched it, I saw it and I watched it at home and I didn't know that they were going to sing the entire movie. I thought it was going to be like, all right, plot, musical number. Yeah. I didn't know that they were going to be singing like, I want some bread. I want some bread. Ah, I want some bread. Like, I didn't know that that was going to be the whole thing. So I turned it off.
John Valjean is just like singing through his entire. Yeah.
I turned it off 5 minutes in, but I did come back to it years later and I do love that movie. But as far as Django Unchained goes, I saw this in theaters.
Yeah.
And it was it wasn't a very full theater. I want to say that me and the girl that I was dating at the time, we were two of four people on our row. It was not very full.
That's
it was
what I
like
feel
Christmas
about
break.
The movie. Yeah, that's what I feel about the movie. Like, I remember my friends going, like, sneaking into that movie because they walked out of Les Mis and they're like, well, let's go see Django because we've heard good things about it. And there, like, wasn't that many people in the theater. That's what I remember most about, like, the movie is, like, there wasn't that many people, but then I heard, like, word of mouth, like, from my friends who had seen it. Like, oh, no, you got to check out Django Unchained. Like, this movie's, like, legit.
See, I thought the trailers looked good, but the main reason why I went to see that movie, I wasn't as in touch with movies as I am now, is I saw Leonardo DiCaprio. Got to go watch it. So yeah, that's what got, especially seeing Leonardo DiCaprio playing a bad guy.
Right.
I'm like,
that's
ooh, I really have
watch.
to, I gotta check this thing out. And I watched it and I really liked it at the time, but it just seemed so long. Well, like, yeah. it was a very long movie. And also, I don't think I had ever seen anything that violent to that point before. So I enjoyed it.
You haven't seen many R-rated movies. You probably hadn't
seen that. No. So it took me a little bit to kind of like figure out where I stood with things and kind of how I was feeling and kind of recalibrate. This movie was the 15th highest grossing movie of 2012. Highest grossing movie of Tarantino's career. $162 million domestically, which is a really good number. And this was a not only a box office success, making $426 million on a $100 million budget worldwide. It was also a big success at the Oscars. It was nominated for five Oscars, and it won two of them, with Tarantino winning for Best Original Screenplay and Christoph Waltz winning his second Oscar for Best Supporting Actor after his win for Inglourious Basterds in the previous Tarantino movie, Inglourious Basterds in 2009, which we will definitely be comparing the two wins for Christoph Waltz, especially when we get to Inglourious Basterds. But this is a story, if you don't know, this is set in the Old West in 1858, Texas. And this is about a slave named Django who trains under a German bounty hunter, Dr. King Schultz, played by Christoph Waltz. And they work together, and eventually they kind of set their course to rescue Django's wife, Carrie Washington, who is a slave at the plantation owned by Calvin Candy, Candyland. That's Leonardo DiCaprio, and madness ensues. And
marketing from a Southern slave owner. Name your plantation Candyland.
I want them to release, and I hope that no kids get it, but I want them to release a version of the Candyland board game that's nothing but Django characters.
That's too far.
There's a quote. Obviously, I can't say it, and we will dance around the issue as carefully as two white boys can, about the use of the N-word in this movie and how there's a lot of people.
Very prominent. Yeah.
Yes. There's people that had, like, it was used so prominently that they were like, I'm out on the movie. Because of that, it's also slaves in the 1850s, so I'm not really sure what people expected. But at the same time, there's a quote that Samuel Jackson has at the end of the movie about Candyland, and I'm like, you should put that on the box for the Django version of Candyland. Whoever's in charge of, like, the MPAA for shut it down.
Hasbro should have been on this for the joke.
I'm telling you, man. And just have that.
I just don't think it would land. I just don't think
Samuel Jackson makes.
No, I feel you. I just don't think it would land the way you think
it would on the shelves. I would buy it.
You would buy it because you love the movie.
I'd play it every day.
And not to sound like I'm like upset at people, but I feel like people would be offended by that board game. If it was on the shelves.
No, I'm with you. I definitely agree with you, but man, it would be so much fun. I'm not gonna sugarcoat it or be like, oh, maybe I like this movie, maybe I don't. I love this movie. This is just one of my favorite movies of the 2010s. It's grown on me so much through the years. And it's, again, we talked about Tarantino and how Reservoir Dogs was, you know, humble beginnings. You had a nice $2 million budget. Hour and a half. This is 2 hours and 45 minutes, and it's $100 million, and it's got the biggest names. It's got, you know, DiCaprio. It's got Jamie Foxx, who it was supposed to be Will Smith, who played Django, which I can't imagine Will Smith doing this. Will Smith's a great actor. I love Will Smith. But I cannot imagine anyone other than James.
No, that's fair. And I do like Jamie Foxx as an actor. Like, as much as he's, like, known for, like, Gold Digger and, like, all these, like, songs and whatnot, like, I like him as an actor. I think he's good. And this movie, he's perfect. Yeah, I mean, he's absolutely perfect in this role. It'd be interesting to see Will Smith in this role, and I think he would pull it off, but I don't think he would do it quite the same way that Jamie Foxx does. And so I think it's a great casting. Now, I did come across a video where basically Tarantino apparently said to Fox, and this is like on a podcast,
he told Fox, we're about to talk about the same video.
If you want to go ahead and explain it, because you might explain it better than I do.
I think it was Howard Stern or something, where basically Jamie Foxx came in and he was acting like Jamie Foxx as Django. He was all cool and suave. And Tarantino was basically like, hey, man, cut the shit. Like, he's a slave at first. He doesn't know how to read. He hasn't been free. He has no confidence. You can't be all cool. He said something about, you come in here with your fucking Gucci bag and your Range Rover. Right. Knock that shit off. And then he just went to set and Jamie Foxx just went on and absolutely killed it. And he was like, yeah, no, I'd absolutely love to work with Tarantino again. That's exactly what I needed to get in the mindset of this character. And the arc of Django in this is so fascinating to watch, because he, at the beginning, he can barely put together a complete sentence. He looks terrified. And by, you know, as things go on, he just gains more and more confidence.
He's out here cooking. Like,
you want to talk about all-time great Western duos, or duos in movies, period. Jamie Foxx and Christoph Waltz as Django and Dr. King Schultz are just unbelievable. They have such great chemistry. First of all, I think it's a shame that Jamie Foxx wasn't nominated for Best Actor.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't know how Denzel Washington got nominated for Flight. Not only is that a bad movie, I don't think it's that great of a performance. Jamie Foxx blows that out of the water tenfold.
I'm never going to diss Denzel, but like that, I mean, it's more Jamie Foxx just didn't get nominated. It's like really the...
I'll take a shot at Flight. Flight's terrible. I really don't like that movie.
No, I haven't seen it, so I don't know if I can take the shot that you can. But I will say, thinking about like actors getting snubbed or actresses getting snubbed, I mean, that's got to be one of like the biggest snubs.
And there's like, we will get to... I think there's an even bigger one in this cast, but Dr. King Schultz, played by Christoph Waltz, is this bounty hunter who comes and he frees Django because he's like, hey, I need to kill these three people and I have no idea what they look like, but you were a former slave of theirs. You know what they look like. You come along with me. I'll grant you your freedom and let's go. And just from the opening scene of the movie with Dr. King Schultz and his damn tooth on the on his little carriage or whatever, It's got a good sense of humor to it, but also at the same time, you get the sense that this guy is the absolute best at what he does. And the camaraderie that he comes to have with Django, and I think it really gets started in the scene that takes place in a tavern where they're talking about what they need to do and kind of what his job is. That, hey, I'm a bounty hunter. This is what a bounty hunter is. And again, they nail it so well, the whole, he doesn't know anything other than being a slave. So things have to be explained to him, with the exception of, and some people think this is a little far-fetched, that Django is just this absolute sniper, you know, with a gun to start out. But he does learn. He gets better. They have the training montage where him and Christoph Waltz are, you know,
you didn't hear
doing business over the winter.
Christoph Waltz character, you didn't hear Schultz. He was like, kid's a natural. He snipes the clan member from like miles away. It's kind of funny. He snipes him out of a tree. But yes, he isn't like, picks up a gun, is immediately like the best shooter in the West or whatever. Yeah.
The scene with the sheriff and the marshal might have been what won Christoph Waltz the Oscar.
Yeah, fair.
It's early enough in the movie that I don't feel bad about spoiling it, but they go into this like saloon And
if people haven't seen this movie by now, I don't feel as bad.
I don't really want to spoil too much. I mean, we will at the end, but there's a scene where they go into a saloon and they don't want Django in that saloon at all. So the sheriff comes out and he's like, "Hey, you got to get out of here. You and Django got to leave." And so he just shoots him point blank. Then the marshal comes around and he's like, "All right, we've got everyone in this town, including old Mary Sue over there, pointing a gun at you and Django." And he just calmly explains that, yeah, that sheriff is actually a wanted outlaw that just went by a different name, and you dumbasses elected him as sheriff. So y'all owe me $200. It's a fantastic scene, and it's a perfect marriage between Christoph Waltz's acting ability and Quentin Tarantino's direction, and these two just kind of work like hand in glove together.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's absolutely perfect. I'm just thinking about, I think we should get into it, is the needle drops in this movie.
Unreal. I think the needle drops in this movie can go toe-to-toe with any movie ever, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah,
agreed.
And I don't know if all of these songs, I know there are some songs that were made specifically for the movie.
Right.
Like there is a, if you haven't seen the movie, you will be very confused when I say this. There's a Rick Ross needle drop in this Western. And I heard about it before I saw the movie.
It's amazing.
And it went so incredibly hard when I was at the movie theater watching it. But every single time since, I'm just like, this just fits. I don't know how. I can't explain it. But this Rick Ross song just fits what's going on right now.
Yeah.
There's a John Legend song later in the movie, and I think it's incredible. And I'm not even the biggest John Legend fan, but it works perfectly. The music at the very end of the movie, the last song that plays, you know, as we go into the end credits, is fantastic. There's a scenario that happens twice in this movie that I'll talk about more in spoilers, and they play the same song, and I think that was a clever callback, and I'm like,
right,
it's like it really feels like a major setback when you hear that music, and it really adds to it.
For Rick Ross's song, are you talking about 100 Black Coffins?
Oh yeah.
Is that what it, yeah? That,
there's no
that,
other. There is one that needle song drop that I didn't think so was hard. As good.
Yeah, but that song goes so hard. It really
does. It does. There's one needle drop that I didn't like too much, and that's just because there's like some spoken word part of it, in a shootout later in the movie, that I just felt like that the timing of it was a bit off. But everything else is so good that I'm not gonna complain.
Right, yeah. Not to spoil any plot, but like when he's going back to Candyland at some point, and the song that plays after he kind of gets his freedom back, and it's like, "I'm doing the Lord's work today," or whatever it says.
That's the John Legend song.
Right, that's the John Legend song.
That song, John Legend needs to like only make music for movies, apparently, because the song he made for La La Land goes hard, and the song he made for Django goes hard. There's also a song called "I Got a Name" that's used
Jim Corsi. Yeah,
that's used in like a montage of Dr. King Schultz and Django just kind of setting out to do business in the winter together, and the cinematography mixed with the song shots. And it's like, just like
the sweeping shots of like the plane as they're like riding on horseback. It's like it just fits. It
the best way that I can describe that scene, and it doesn't really fit the rest of the movie.
No, it doesn't. But it's completely
but this particular scene makes you feel like you're an 8-year-old watching a Western on your dad's lap.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just like, "Hey, like Dad, show me one of your favorite
John Wayne."
Yeah, yep. "Show me one of your favorite John Wayne movies, Dad." And you're just watching that on like some 12-inch TV together.
Yeah, like, with the antenna up. Yeah, exactly.
The vibes are kind of immaculate as far as that goes.
Yeah.
Speaking of immaculate, go ahead.
No, the last thing I was going to say about needle drops, I started playing this as you started talking about Django at the beginning of the podcast. I mean, when we started talking about Django, when you were introducing the movie, I think it's the perfect intro to any movie imaginable, is the intro literally titled Django. And it's just like, Django! And it's just like Django. The music. Yeah, the music is so amazing. And I just absolutely love it. I think it might be one of the best, like, opening like intros of a movie like ever. Like, it is so good. And I know that the opening scenes is like slavers like walking slaves like in chains across you know, like to another place, and it like it shouldn't fit and it shouldn't feel like it works, but it does. It just absolutely works. And then there's a callback to it, and it's just so good. And yeah, that's the last thing I was going to say about like the music and like needle drops. Like this song could have won for music, and I kind of hope it did at the Oscars. It probably didn't, but like, if you told me that 100 Black Coffins like won best original song, I wouldn't even like argue with you. You know what I mean?
It didn't get nominated.
That's but ridiculous. Two, absolutely ridiculous.
When I tell you what won, you're going to be like, oh yeah, no, that was a lock, automatic. No one else had a chance in hell.
Was it Anne Hathaway?
No, because that's not an original song.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair.
Skyfall by Adele.
Oh well, yeah. I mean,
from the opening credits of Skyfall. Yeah.
To be honest, if they come to you as a songwriter and they're like, "Hey, we want you to write the opening theme for a James Bond movie," you're probably winning an Oscar for it.
And it's Adele, and it's one of the best Bond movies ever.
Right.
And maybe the best Bond song ever.
That is the best Bond song ever.
I agree.
I'm with it. I'm on it. Because Billie Eilish is great, and I love No Time to Die.
And she won too. Yeah. And so did Sam Smith. And a lot of people hated Sam Smith's. I didn't. But it's definitely not as good as Adele's or Billie Eilish's.
I think every single one they've done has crushed. Like if they come to Madonna. You can feel the way
Craig
you feel. You can feel the way you feel about the Madonna song, but I'm just telling you, if they come to you as a songwriter and they're like, "Hey, we want you to write the opening theme for a Bond film," I mean, I feel like you're going to get nominated for an Oscar. I mean, you're just automatically getting nominated. So, that makes sense though. Skyfall winning. But yeah, go ahead. What else are you going to say?
Some of the big supporting actors that come in the middle part of the movie. And I remember sitting there waiting, like, when is this person coming?
Okay, like, this was marketing. Like, marketed as, like, yeah, this guy's part of the movie.
But we'll get to it. Don Johnson in this movie playing Colonel Sanders, I thought was just incredible. He's not Colonel Sanders. He plays a character called Big Daddy. But
he might as well be Colonel
Sanders. He might as well have been Colonel Sanders. And I thought that he was just
he delivers one of my
and yet funny and he, right. There's memes to be had for days.
Oh, there's so many memes
from his character in
this
movie.
He delivers one of my favorite lines. It's just like, oh, well, in that case, come on in, have some cool drink.
There's also Tarantino's good at dialogue that has nothing to really do with the script, but it kind of does.
But it makes you where it works. Yeah,
it makes the world feel lived in, because like there's a scene where he's got to talk to one of his slaves and say like, "Hey, you're not supposed to treat Django like any
he's
of the slaves
man.
Around here.
He's not
because
he's free.
He's
a free man.
But you better not talk to him like any of the white guys around here, that's for sure."
I love that when he's like, "Oh, well, I didn't say that." And she's like, "Well, I don't understand." Yeah. And she's like, "Well, I don't understand you then." And he's like, no, that makes sense.
I can see that.
And then he's like, "Who's that? Who's that boy that goes to the bar? Oh, Jeremy. Treat him like Jeremy." It's just so funny.
It's a really and not to mention, if this was going to get a win for costume design, Django.
I think the costumes work. Like, to be honest, I think
it didn't even get nominated for costume design.
I mean,
I don't know how.
I understand Reservoir Dogs not getting like costume because like that's low budget and like there's nothing there, but like costumes for this one, I just think it how did that not get nominated? You know,
like, it's you so good. Can't be serious.
So good. Who that like what movie won
costume? I haven't seen Anna Karenina. That one, it's a period piece. British, those okay, always take fair. It.
Those always win costume. Yeah.
Les Mis, Lincoln, and Snow White and the Huntsman, fine, whatever. But Mirror?
Yeah.
The goofy ass Snow White movie? No. Yeah, no.
People want a Snow White kick. No. They just want a Snow White.
Yeah, you got two Snow White movies. Pick one and give the other to Django. Let's get to DiCaprio and Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, this is my favorite
Leonardo DiCaprio performance.
Right.
It's my favorite performance of his, and he wasn't even nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
I think the only movie that rivals it for me in terms of performance is The Departed.
See, I would go with Wolf of Wall Street.
Or Wolf of Wall Street.
Level of performance.
Because I think those two are interchangeable in terms of.
And like I'm glad that he was worked with Tarantino again in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He's great in that as well. Yeah. But DiCaprio just
this
gets
is
to
him. This is him.
This is just. And Samuel Jackson kind of had to have a talk with DiCaprio about using the N word because no one uses it more than DiCaprio in this movie. Maybe that's not entirely true, but like he's a very prominent user of that word in this. And.
So was he going off script when he was saying all that, or like is
no? It's a matter of he wasn't comfortable saying it, and a lot of people
had to be like
Samuel Jackson had to be like, "Hey, look, man, let's do this."
It's a period. It's like it's the time period. Like go into it. Like say it. Like you're gonna be okay. Like it works. Yeah. No, okay, that makes sense. Because I think that's what, I feel like that's what Jamie Foxx and Samuel L. Jackson very much have that opinion of it, and they always defend this movie as like, I understand why people don't like that they're using the N-word with the hard R, and they're saying it all the time, but like, this is 1850. Like, this is what they would have, this is how they would have been talking. So, it makes sense. That's interesting that he had to like talk to him and Leo like had to like kind of get over it. But man, is he so good as a character? Like, I'm assuming once he got over that hiccup, it was like, all right, I'm going to go full into this. Like, I'm going to do my Leonardo DiCaprio thing and I'm just going to go head on into this like a car crash. Like, I'm about to be the best villain you've ever seen on a screen. Like, that's kind of what he comes
scenes.
Up to be.
In this movie where I'm just like, are there other people on the screen? You have everyone else is giving Oscar level performances, but DiCaprio is just like, move, bitch.
The scene with the skull and the hammer.
I will talk to you probably know the story behind that scene. Maybe you don't.
Maybe I don't. Yeah.
But I will tell you about that when we get to spoilers, but that scene's incredible. There's a scene with him where he's yelling about his sister that's just fucking hilarious, if I'm going to be honest. Every interaction
with him and his sister, I feel like
there's got to be. He's fucking that sister, let's be honest.
Okay.
Let's call it what it is. No one is that excited to see their sister.
A spade is a spade. Yeah.
Nah, he was way too happy. No, that's
yeah.
But
so
also
Leo was awesome, but let's be real. How good was Samuel L. Jackson? And like once I put together, and I think he said this in like interviews before, once I put together that he was basically like portraying Uncle Ruckus from like Boondocks, I was like, this man gets it. I was like, this is an amazing performance. It's just
from
awesome.
The first time that you see him and he's just mean mugging the shit out of Django coming into Candyland on a horse.
Who's this black guy on this horse?
Yeah.
Like, who's this guy?
As soon as you get just a taste of who this guy is, you're like, all right, I'm gonna enjoy watching the back and forth between him and Django and him and DiCaprio. And DiCaprio's I want to see what happens about him.
Like, as he's walking back to the house after he yells at him, like, this is our guest. Like, you're going to go fix the rooms because I said so. And you, then he's, like, still, like, running his mouth.
Bastard.
Yeah, and then he's still running his mouth. And DiCaprio's line is, like, the lip on that boy, I swear. Like, I just can't get over it. It's so good. It is so good. The chemistry between DiCaprio, Fox, and Samuel L. Jackson, and like the clashing of like those three characters in almost like a triangle, is just, it just blows my mind how good it is. Like, it
there's
is so
also
good.
Something in this movie that I've never seen used the way that it is before, but there's like three or four scenes where someone says something and it's like this super zoom with like a sound effect. And it's the greatest thing ever.
That is so Tarantino. I don't even know if he's done it in other movies, but like, that is so Tarantino.
Jamie Foxx says something on a staircase to somebody that he just met that's like the funniest thing I've heard in a long time. And it's just this zoom out with the same sound effects to get everyone else's reaction. And then DiCaprio, when they first meet him, and you know, the very first time you see his face, it's just this goofy guy. And it's just like this zoom in with this like whoosh sound. It's fantastic.
Whoosh. Yeah, yeah. What, didn't Steven like say something to him and he like turned, like Django turns around and it's like whoosh, like onto his face, and then it just cuts to like another scene.
And me mugging the shit out of Samuel Jackson. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, and then it just cuts. It just cuts to like another part of the scene. It's so funny. I love this movie. I absolutely love it. I think it's great.
If I was to give any complaints, the only complaint that I have, and this is a complaint that I've had from the, and maybe I'm just a bitch, I don't know. There's a scene that, I think that there's a shootout scene that just gets kind of repetitive, and I feel like it was just a little too sudden for what was going on. And then there's also a scene where Jamie Foxx is hanging upside down, and I'm just like, I get it, but it just feels a little gratuitous.
Yeah, the way they shot that scene, I mean, I get it.
Yeah, the way they shot that scene is like, I don't want to be looking at this.
Yeah, I don't want to be looking at his, let's just call it large cojones.
Well, you don't see me. Yeah, you don't see anything.
But you see the cojones. You see the cojones. You definitely see his. Yeah. Oh no. I watched it last night. You see his. Yeah,
maybe you were just looking back.
No. I mean, it's right there in your face. You can't miss it.
I did.
Yeah. Well. No. Yeah. I mean, some of the shots are like kind of bizarre, but it's also like, that's who Tarantino is. So I'm like, I'm kind of honestly the Monsieur Candy's occupation, or like what he does as like a living, is kind of like rubs me the wrong way. Like I get what it is and like get what they're doing, but like the fight club aspect, or like the fighting ring that he has, is very like, it's kind of like, I'm trying to figure out a good way to put this. It's very It leaves you feeling a little queasy, like a little like you're flinching at it, like, ew, that's a little like
with that one shot. I feel like it's just so like, I get what you're trying to do, but I feel like,
are you talking about in the fight when like they do the Foley scene,
like that Jamie Foxx scene you were talking about, where the camera's kind of set up and you're looking between his legs at Samuel L. Jackson. The type of grotesque that I like in this movie is like when Django shoots a guy and his blood goes spattering over the cop.
Right.
That's a great shot.
That's awesome.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's the type of thing that I love in this movie.
Same with like the shootout in Candyland, like the shootout in the house.
Yeah.
Like
there's some blood on a flower everywhere. That I think, I mean, is really, it's like,
we don't usually do this,
man,
but
that's really artistic. I like it.
Yeah. We don't usually do this, but let's give a shout out to the Foley artist. Like,
yeah,
the Foley artists were in their bag. Like, they were doing whatever they wanted.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, some of these shots were great. Some of the sounds were just like, it's just the bullet whizzing and it's like, like when it hits the when it hits bodies, it's so interesting. I really loved it. That was something that was awesome to like experience, kind of.
I'm giving this an A+. It is up there for me. And I thought this was going to come in above Pulp Fiction, but Pulp Fiction was just so much better than I remembered it being.
Fair enough.
This is going to get a 66.64.
No, that's a good one.
I love the movie. It's fantastic. It would be
a high A+.
It's higher than Top Gun Maverick, like yours was with Reservoir Dogs. It's higher than that. So there are definitely years that this would have been my favorite movie. And I don't know if 2012 is one of those years. I'm unreasonably high on Silver Linings Playbook. That movie just connects to me on a level that I'm not quite sure I can explain.
It's an awesome movie.
And when we do end up getting to that, I'm sure I will be able to put it into words. But Django Unchained is probably the better made movie of those two. That just doesn't connect to me quite the same. But when we get into spoilers, we can definitely go into Django and, you know, how people could connect with some stuff.
Right. So for me, I had Reservoir Dogs at an 80.8 A+. And this is going to be an A+. It's no doubt about it. It's Tarantino. I love Tarantino. I'm giving this an 80.9. So 1.1 higher. But I'll say this. I think it's the better movie. And I think I like it more, but it's close, and it's really close.
So this is your number one Tarantino movie?
Right now, yes.
Nice. All
right. Right now,
yes. So right now, your number one is Django, Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction.
But to be fair, Pulp Fiction is a high A+. I mean, it's higher than like even an A+ that, I mean, it's very close to the A+ that I might be higher than the A+ you gave, because I have it at 70.5, so... I think it's awesome. Yeah.
I'm Pulp Fiction, Django, and then a bit of a gap, Reservoir Dogs, but I still love all three.
But I do want to preface this by saying that I don't know if you're going to find someone who loves Tarantino as much as I do. Like, I was telling you before we started the podcast, and I think I'm just going to go ahead and let the audience know, I think Tarantino is my second favorite director behind Christopher Nolan.
All right.
So it makes sense
to like
why,
both of those guys, with no one winning that Oscar.
Right, exactly. It makes sense to me as to why I like this film, or like why I like these movies so much, because I just think it captures what I want out of a movie. And I just think when it comes to writing and directing, like, you can talk about his acting, and it's really funny that he gives himself like basically throwaway roles in movies that he like writes and directs, but there's no denial that he is like one of the better writers and directors in Hollywood, in my opinion.
Let's go ahead and dive into spoilers, starting with Django Unchained. I really liked the chemistry between Walt and Fox. I thought they played off each other really well. And once they get to Candyland, their goal is to rescue Broomhilda. And so they kind of want to come across like they want to buy one of his
willing to spend $12,000 on one of his slaves that's like a fighter, and like they're in the fight business or whatever with the slaves, but they're willing to spend $12,000 on that, and then they're going to spend what, $400, $500 on Broomhilda. Yeah. Hildy, which is Django's wife.
But they don't plan on really exchanging money.
Right. They were going to rip him off, basically, right?
Yeah.
They were going to kill.
And until Samuel L. Jackson is like, they're playing their ass for a fool. They know each other. One of the best scenes.
Yeah, one of the best scenes.
It really is a good one. And then DiCaprio being... Calvin Candy being the showman that he is just has to bring out this... This skull, and he's pretty much talking about how black people are more docile submissive, because of dimples.
Yeah, servant
skull,
dude. And it's like, okay, this is a little whack job. Science,
I'm sure there are unfortunately people that still believe stuff like that. But in that scene, DiCaprio has this big outburst about like. You know, he's like slams the table and, hey, you know, put your hands on the tabletop, and there's like a gun that comes out, and there's DiCaprio.
There's been a lot of lying going on at this table.
But that you can believe.
Yeah, yeah.
DiCaprio's, I mean, that whole, like, gentleman, you had my curiosity, now you have my attention. That's become, like, a staple that people say. That wasn't said before DiCaprio. Right. But he cut his hand in one of the takes. I know that you probably noticed that.
Yeah,
DiCaprio,
he's just like bleeding.
He smears blood on Kerry Washington's face.
Did he not mean to cut his hand?
He did not mean to cut his hand. I think he broke a bone in his hand and had blood. Now, there are a lot of people saying, now if he went forward with that, that's nasty because he smeared his own blood on Kerry Washington's face. No. It was because in that scene where he's, you know, slamming down on the table, it was such a good take that they were like, all right, let's get blood on his hand and let's use that for the next, you know, like fake blood.
Oh, fake
and
blood.
Let's use that now. So they kind of, edited
together
so that they could use that take because
it
was so good.
I think you can tell like how they edited it, because they kind of like jump away from DiCaprio to Butch.
Yeah,
which is DiCaprio's like secondhand man, and then they jump back to DiCaprio and he's like bleeding. So that is well done. I thought you were about to say something wild, like he went off script, he like broke his hand and then he had blood in his hand. He was just like,
No.
Yeah, I'm about to smear this in her face. Like, you know, let's just see what happens. But
there were the people for years that thought that.
Who thought that was a real thing?
Who thought that, like, because it was always told that DiCaprio actually like hurt himself and was bleeding. So people were saying that, oh, so she just smeared his own blood on Kerry Washington.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, that's
Kerry Washington had to be like, no, that didn't happen. That didn't happen.
But he plays the character so well and he gets in the character so much that it really is believable. Like, it's believable that he would do that. So,
and also props to Quentin Tarantino for saying, that's a good take. I have an idea of where to take this. And it worked out really well. But as a result, they get the drop on him, and it's all right. There needs to be like some money exchanged before you guys can leave with Broomhilda.
She's the right person for you.
And yeah. Dr. King Schultz is not taking this L nicely.
Oh no, my favorite quote. One of my favorite quotes from Candy and Schultz exchange. I think you're a terrible loser. Well, I think you're an abhorrent winner.
An abysmal winner.
Yeah, an abysmal winner is what he says. Sorry, abysmal. I think that exchange is so great.
I like when he's talking about, I wonder what Alexander Dumont would have to say about this.
Yeah, Dumont.
And he's
Dumont.
You don't think he'd approve, soft-hearted Frenchie. And he's like, Alexander Dumont was black. And DiCaprio, right. I thought you would want to know because you named your prized fighter after one of his main characters. And then, you know, hey,
oh,
you signed all the papers.
So mad. He's
But DiCaprio's just like, I kind of want one last little just smear it in your face. You need to shake my hand before we leave. And if you don't, kill him. So, Christoph Waltz is like, fine, you insist. And then, you know, that little sound effect, his gun pops out of his wrist. He shoots him right in that little flower, and he starts falling over, and all hell breaks loose. Butch shoots Dr. King Schultz.
Right. Schultz
Django
immediately goes
Django shoots Butch, and then everyone's like, we finally have an excuse to kill Django.
Right. Is it one of the best lines Christoph Waltz like delivered? It was like,
if
couldn't
you
resist.
Insist.
Right, if you insist. And then he shoots him. And then he turns to Django. And this is like 2 seconds before he gets like blasted with a sawed-off shotgun. He goes like, couldn't help myself. And I was
sorry.
Oh, that's such a
I couldn't
great
resist.
Ending. Right.
That was
such a
great
ending for a character.
And then there's a big shootout. Django and Broomhilda both end up taking L's. Broomhilda basically ends up back where she was, and Django is going to get sold to the LaQuint Dickey Mining Company. And they're like, well, these are the worst on slaves. You know, you're working in a mine, and it's terrible.
They don't care
but
about
he
you.
He still has a handbill from one of his earlier, from his first his first bounty. Because Dr. King Schultz says it's always good luck to keep your first handbill from your first kill. And he convinces these guys at the LaQuint Dickey Mining Company that, like, hey, they're down at Candyland and we can go get this and go get all the money and I'll help you with it. And they're like, yeah, no, this sounds great. You and then he just like kills all of them and runs off with a horse.
You seem like a stand-up citizen.
It's a fantastic scene where you just see how far Django's come from. Like, he says at one point, he's like, do I sound like a fucking slave? It's one of my favorite lines in the whole movie. It's like, you really sold that. No, you don't.
No, you sound like a person who was not put through that. It's just interesting. Also, a shout out to Tarantino, because again, being a throwaway role, he gives himself one of those.
I did like him best in this because he only has like two lines, and I thought that it worked. Well. But yeah. I really like. There's a scene of like smoke clearing, and then Django just appears, and like. That's great cinematography right there. I love it.
If you told me that was Dune 2 and Paul Atreides, I wouldn't know the difference.
But there's a character that Django runs into earlier when he's trying to be a tough ass to kind of sell the fact that he is call One-Eyed Charlie. And he's kind of like giving this guy shit about like, get the molasses out your ass or I'll kick your teeth in so hard your grandma will shit out bricks or something like that. But he's talking to this one slave and just giving him a really hard time.
I'm worse than these white men. Yeah, I'm worse than these white men. Like, you know,
yeah, exactly. And the slave is there. He also got sold to LaQuint Dickey Mining Company, and he's there and he sees what Django did and he kind of understands, like, Django like frees these three slaves and there's like a brief little smile that comes across his face as Django's riding off. And it's like, I'm glad that he understood what Django was doing. It was a nice little callback to something earlier in the movie where it's like, that's not who he is. I liked that.
Right. Game, respect, game. No, I'm just kidding.
And then end of the movie, he shoots Walton Goggins in the penis. And shoots Samuel L. Jackson, blows up Candyland, amazing. Rides off into the sunset with Kerry Washington. A fantastic end credit song that's basically just like, it might as well be Stilgar singing about Paul in Dune 2, but it's this guy singing about how cool Django is.
Right.
It's a great song. It's a great, I don't know what the name of, and by the way, that song that you mentioned from the beginning of the movie that plays when they're walking across Texas or whatever, it plays again when he's in chains walking to the LaQuint Dickey Mining Company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great job of selling that, like, man, we were riding such a high and now
we're back.
We're kind of back where we were and he gets out of that situation
in chains
quickly.
Again. Yeah. In chains.
It's like Django rechained there for a minute. But if you don't have anything else to add about Django, we can move back to Reservoir Dogs and I'll kind of
I only got two scenes to talk about. So Michael Madsen's character as Mr. Blonde, like when he cuts the cop's ear off, like, and then starts pouring gasoline on him, like, it's grotesque. And to be honest, it's a little too far, but I get what they're going for. Like, I really do. I get why the scene's in the movie. I understand why it's there, but it's a little too grotesque for me. And then they show his ear, like the side of like missing basically. And it's not a pretty sight.
The fact that they didn't show it happening, but at the same time, for me, it was the gasoline where it's just like, this is getting a little too real here. Like,
this guy's literally about to like set this place on fire.
But then
arson is about to be added to his list of crimes.
Yeah, but then Tim Roth, some fucking how, after drowning in 18 gallons of blood,
hero man
came out of his body, shoots him, and you find out that he is
an undercover cop
that's been working with the police.
Yeah.
And I always had my suspicions.
Were you surprised?
No, I wasn't surprised.
Like when you first watched it? Yeah.
If I was like putting money on it, he would be the one with the top odds. But it's not like other
movies.
It's
well played. Yeah.
God, we talked about something lately where it was like such and such was played off as a twist and it really shouldn't have been. This, I had enough times where I was like, maybe it's him. Maybe it's him.
I mean, at one point, I was like, is it Mr. Blue? Like, they just don't show him on screen, but it's actually Mr. Blue? Like, I was like, yeah.
There were enough times where I was like, maybe it's Joe. Maybe it's Harvey Keitel. Maybe it's, like, I never thought it was Chris Penn.
Because Chris Penn is so, like, adamant that, like, there isn't a rat. Like, maybe it's him.
I never once thought it was Michael Madsen because, like, come on.
He's almost too absurd.
Yeah, no. Like, you wouldn't be doing all this if you stop, unless you're an idiot. But I thought that was well played, and I liked that they showed you enough of it. And his, I don't know who the guy is that played the guy that was kind of like walking him through being undercover and the stuff that he needed to do. But I liked their
hold away.
I thought that was well done.
Yeah. I'll give him a shout out. Randy Brooks was hold away.
Yeah. No. Good job. I liked their dynamic.
Yeah. I like that exchange between those two, and really the only other scene I really wanted to talk about that's kind of a spoiler is it's not really a spoiler because it happens at the very beginning of the movie, but Tim Roth absolutely leaking blood and just screaming in the back seat, and like the way he's like screaming is like edgy and like disturbing, and he's like, he can't breathe. He's like,
it makes you feel,
he shot me. Oh,
it makes
God,
you feel like you are in a car with one of your friends and something horrible just happened, and you're trying to find a way to deal with it, but like you're also trying to keep him calm.
I'm sorry, Larry, I'm gonna die, Larry. Like, I mean, that's why I was almost surprised that Tim Roth didn't get a nomination. Because, like, I think those, like, 7 minutes of Tim Roth is just, like, unfiltered, like, brilliance by someone who should be dying and, like, is dying on screen. And, like, you feel it. Like, you feel the pain of, like, this person dying in front of your eyes on screen. And, I mean, he plays it so well, in my opinion. I don't know if you have any more scenes to talk about, but those
basically
are kind of
basically everyone dies.
Yeah. Well,
they have like a
the
big
ending
time
scene
shoot off.
The ending scene is wild, right? I mean, the police come in, like everyone else is basically dead, and Tim Roth's character, after he's, you know, bleeding out and the police are like coming in, and like there's three, I mean, what would you call it? Like an old fashioned like standoff where all three of them like shoot each other at the exact same time. And they're like, two of them die. It was like Nice Guy Eddie and Joe die. And then Harvey Keitel's character, Mr. White, is like also dying at that point. Like he's on the ground, like, and he's holding Tim Roth's character. Cause Tim Roth's character is like, I'm sorry, you had to get shot. Like, and then Tim Roth's character just goes, oh, by the way, I'm sorry, Larry. Like, I was.
Yeah.
I'm the cop. I'm a cop. And then you could just see on Harvey Keitel's, on Mr. White's face, he's like, you got to be kidding me. Like, I just defended this guy.
I've been defending this guy for the whole movie. And
right, all day. Yeah.
But you also, Harvey Keitel, I really think he's the standout of this thing for me, which, again, he's probably the main star, so saying the main standout probably isn't too bold, but he also does a great job of selling the exhaustion at the end of it.
That's
just like, I've been going to bat for you this whole time, but I'm tired as hell. I know the cops are coming.
I'm
Steve
done.
And Jimmy just walked off with all the diamonds, and he probably just walked into a bunch of gunfire from police. So no
you
one's
hear it in the background. He gets like absolutely obliterated by the police. Like,
So no one's walking away with anything from this. Our leader's dead because I just shot him. I'm just exhausted.
My ranking in this movie is Tim Roth, Harvey Keitel, And in my opinion, it's Buscemi and Chris Penn as the next, like, tier down in terms of acting performances. Because I think Chris Penn, as Nice Guy Eddie, gives a sneaky good performance. As, like, he's just kind of, you know, all over the place. And he's like, listen here, there is no rat. There is no rat.
Did you know that I have personally,
like, vetted these people. There is no rat. Like, yeah. I just think it's so funny.
Did you know that he is Sean Penn's brother? Or he was. He's been dead for a bit now.
Yeah, yeah, I knew that, yeah.
So, this was definitely a good place to start for Tarantino. I think it does a good job of setting up the things that he likes to do, while also giving hints of some more stuff to come.
Right, Hateful Eight, Pulp Fiction. Yeah.
So, that is the Reservoir Dogs and Django Unchained review. Guys, if we have not sold you on seeing these movies, then maybe
just
skip the Tarantino series.
Right, yeah, exactly. I was going to say, I thought you were connecting these two movies, and I was thinking in my head, like, how do these two movies connect? I was like, maybe Mitchell just loves, like, bloody shootouts. And he's like, oh, I had to pick between Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Reservoir Dogs. And I just want Reservoir Dogs is like bloody shootouts in the middle of a movie. But no, this is as good as it gets from Tarantino. And I absolutely love these movies.
Well, Brandon, you definitely wanted to stick with the Tarantino, so you're going to get your wish. Next up, Kill Bill Volume 1 and Kill Bill Volume 2. If I have to explain to you why those two are getting the podcast together, then there's no hope. I think that's pretty obvious. Then we're going to go with Inglourious Basterds and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I will keep that in the pocket as to why until we get there. I'm sure a few of you might be able to figure it out. And then finally, Jackie Brown and The Hateful Eight. And that'll wrap things up for the Quentin Tarantino session. And once we finish with that, we'll kind of look back and give our overall thoughts on Tarantino's filmography and our final rankings after we had seen all nine of Quentin Tarantino's theatrically released movies. So, Brandon, thanks for joining me as we go through these Tarantino films. And also, if you had any curiosity about Tarantino's work, hopefully after watching these, you check out some of the other stuff and maybe watch along with us as we dive into the filmography of one of the greatest directors of our time.
Definitely.
All right. Well, we'll be right back at it again with Kill Bill Volume 1 and Kill Bill Volume 2 next. Yeah, have a good one.